And so welcome all to this week's Q&A session. I think it's, I don't recognize any new names in the list. If there are any new people with us, welcome. If you want to become a member of the PC user group, the link to get to our website to join is in the chat window. But feel free to continue joining as a guest if you choose to do so. So we have quite a few items on the agenda tonight. I'll kick it over to Alan to lead us through tonight's deck. Alan, oh, hang on. Alan, take it away.
Okay, thank you, Chris. We'll get right into it then. And first of all, we have a couple of follow-up items on a question that came up last week. Basically, the question was, what's the best way to copy material from a cassette tape to digital media? And of course, there are several ways to do it, and the best one is always the one that works for you, basically that works for the equipment that you're trying to use. Now, the question was specific to cassettes, but the other things that you might want to do are you might have a collection of vinyl records that you want to play on a turntable and record as MP3s, let's say. Or you might want to record audio directly from the internet. There's a lot of sound files and music and audio tracks and things, as we've heard from Bob Walker, available on the internet, and you can obviously access those. But there's basically two things that you're going to need. Firstly, you're going to need some kind of audio recording software. There's a computer club, so that's a good thing to need software. And the second thing is possibly if you have a device that you're trying to access, you'll need some kind of cable to connect that media player to your computer. Now, quite a number of years ago, it turns out, I wrote this article because I was interested in copying vinyl records at that time to CDs, those brand new silver discs. And I said that you could do it for less than $5. And note the date there is 2005, so my calculation, that's about 17 years ago. So the $5 was basically you could go down Canadian Tire and buy a 3.5mm stereo jack to a twin RCA jack stereo adapter cable. And lo and behold, that thing is still available at Canadian Tire, but due to the wonders of inflation, it's now copying for less than $10 because the equipment is now, the cable is now basically $8 plus tax. So things have gone up slightly. And then the second thing you need, and of course, this is the cable that I need for my particular audio system, because what I'm trying to do is connect a hi-fi amplifier, because I've got a turntable connected to an amp, and I want to connect the amplifier through those two RCA jacks to the stereo jack here that plugs into the sound card on my laptop. So that's the cable I need, and you will need whatever fits your equipment. And Bob Walker is going to be talking some more about this shortly, and he's got a whole raft of examples on the type of cables that you might have to use. And then the second thing you need is some recording software. And over the years, I've used a number of different programs, and I've written articles on several of them. And the latest one is actually quite new. I found this program in the spring of this year. So this is an article from the newsletter in April, and it's a program called Ocean Audio, which comes from I think it's Venezuela or something. No, Brazil, I think it is. It's a university research group in Brazil that have developed this open source sound editor. But as with all software products, the real trick, they're typically dead easy to use. They have these audio controls up the top here. There's a big red record button and a stop button and forwards and backwards type thing, just as if you had a kind of a cassette player or something like that. But the real trick is to get into the edit menu and find the preferences or settings. And in particular, in this case, I want the sound settings. And you'll find that you've got a bunch of drop-down menus, and the important ones are the playback device, and I'm selecting here the speakers or the headphone jack. And then the second one is the recording device. So right now it's set for stereo mix, which will be my sound card. But really, you've got to get these two things right, or you're not going to be recording information and not going to be playing it back as you would wish. So it's really critical. And one thing you can do is to go into Windows Control Panel and select the sound settings and see what devices are available on your system. So for example, here, if I'm recording from the internet, then I'm selecting the input here. And what I do is I choose the stereo mix, which is the sound card. You can see that by default, my laptop is set up to use the microphone, because that's how I'm talking to you tonight. The input device is the microphone on the laptop. But if I want to record from the internet, I don't want to use the microphone. I want to use the onboard line-in, as it were, the sound card. So that's my input device. And then on the output side, typically I leave that set as being the headphone jack or the external speakers on my that are plugged into the laptop. However, if I connect by using that magic $5 cable, then I have to switch again because now I get this option for line in, which is essentially the cable coming in to the sound card. So this is basically the output from my hi-fi amplifier, which I want to use as the input into the computer and hence the sound program. So as I say, you have to get the input and the output correct, and then you can record. And then once you've got those things set, recording is actually dead easy. As I say, you hit the record button here. I've changed one of the settings so I can view the sound levels here and make sure nothing's going into the red. And then I can see the stereo channels here, left and right. I can expand the waveform using these plus and minus buttons here and see what's going on. And this is Pete Roberts. It's not our Pete Roberts. It's Pete Roberts from Grimthorpe Colliery Band, and he's playing the soprano, cornet, and flowerdale. If anybody's interested in brass band music, it's a beautiful piece of music. And then once you've done the recording, then you go into the File, Save As menu, and now you see that you have a whole raft of options. You can save it as WAV, I usually save them as MP3s. Typically, that's a compressed format. You have the ability to save them as OGG, which is a Linux-type streaming format. All kinds of different ways to save your music file. So those are basically the two things that you need: a cable that hooks up to your device and some software that will do the recording for you. And now we'll turn it over to Bob Walker, who's got more words of wisdom than I just gave you. Are you going to screen share, Bob?
Yes, I will. Let me just click here. And wonders of modern technology here. Okay. So last week there was a question about digitizing cassette tapes, and they asked about the app I'd mentioned a few weeks before. I didn't have that info at hand at the time because it's on another computer, because my regular computer has been in and out of the shop for warranty service twice now. So I'm not very organized yet. The app that I mentioned before was NCH's Golden Records, and we covered how it can be used to convert vinyl records and cassette tapes to digital audio, and you can choose what format you want. The software can remove hiss, clicks, pops from old tapes or scratched records. It can normalize the volume of recordings when converting to CD. It'll automatically detect the silence to split the audio into tracks. So if you're recording one side of an LP record, it'll automatically make as many files as there are tracks. You can apply the phono equalization, so no special phono preamp is required, and we'll cover that in just a minute. So you can connect the turntable directly to the computer. And if you have some old 78 RPM records that you've been left and you don't have a 78 RPM turntable, you can play it on a regular turntable at 45 RPMs, and the software will make the conversion. And Golden Records also has the software to burn the music to a CD if that's what you want to do with it. And there's a URL to get to it. Now, assuming you already have a good turntable or cassette deck, you need the appropriate cables and adapters to connect from your computer. For more information, there's the Golden Records Hardware Setup Guide, and we're going to get into that in just a second. You can also buy a turntable that has a USB output, so you can just plug it into your USB input. Those have been readily available in the last few years, and they're fairly reasonable price. The quality, sound quality, if you're looking for the ultimate, you wouldn't be digitizing it anyway, but they're fairly decent. You can also use the Golden Record software to recover music from any 8-tracks, provided you have a suitable 8-track player that still works. But the quality will be the quality of the 8-tracks from way back when. So this is from the Golden Records setup guide here. This is the preferred way to digitize the music from your turntable. And it you plug it into an amplifier that has a phono input in the middle, and then plug it into the sound card of your PC. The workaround is you plug the output from your turntable into a mic input on the audio card there, and it will do the necessary equalization and preamplification for you. So if you don't have a proper amplifier, this is the workaround. If you're going to record from a cassette player or from a an 8-track player or from any other such source, you can plug the output directly into your the line input on your audio card, on your sound card, and get it. And they recommend these are the three cables you'll need for most circumstances. Now, most common standard way to move an analog sound signal between devices is what they call line level. For example, between a cassette deck and an amplifier, or between a preamplifier and the amplifier. It's normally about half a volt. And pretty much all the sound cards for computers have a line in and line out, sometimes referred to as audio in or audio out connections. But as far as I know, there's very few laptops that have a dedicated line in. As Alan just mentioned, you can go into the settings for your computer and use the microphone in jack and reconfigure it as a line in jack and get around this limitation. But very few of them have a dedicated line in. Now, microphones put out a much weaker signal than the so-called line level. So devices that can use microphones have separate microphone in or mic in connections, including most computer sound cards and many laptop computers. Laptop computers can have a separate mic in jack, or what a lot of them do now, because they're getting thinner and lighter, is they have a unified jack that handles the mic in, and in this case, the mic in is strictly mono and not stereo, and the headset out, which is stereo. And the idea is you can plug in a headset with built-in mic into this unified jack. And depending on the particular laptop model, you may or may not have other mic in or audio out jacks. The device that amplifies a microphone signal to the line level, they call this a preamp, and it's usually built into any device designed to use mics. And most microphones in a consumer environment use some sort of phone connector, and we'll look at that in just a second. Now, most phonograph cartridges on a good quality turntable have a very low output level and require a preamp in normal use. Typically, a home stereo amplifier or receiver will have a special phono input. This input passes the signal through a phono preamp, which also equalizes the signal properly, as well as boosting it to line level. And most turntables use RCA connectors. So we'll have a look at the connectors here. Line level, microphone, and phono input signals often use the same two families of connectors, and that's RCA and what they call phone. The phone connector was originally designed for the old telephone switchboards you see in the old movies there, where the operator had to switch things around. And that's where the design originally came from. RCA connectors are all the same size, and they're all mono only. So the stereo cable with RCA connectors has two connectors at each end. And there's video cables that have up to five RCA connectors at each end. Phone connectors were originally quarter inch barrel diameter. But now they come in three sizes, the quarter inch, the mini, and the sub mini. And most of the phone connectors on laptops tend to be the minis. And they can carry one signal for mono, two signals for stereo, or three signals for a headset. And there's actually applications that do up to five signals on one of these connectors, and you can tell by the number of stripes on the business end. So just to confuse everything even more, the same connectors are also widely used for video signals, especially RCA and home theater applications, and there are several other types of connectors for both audio and video signals. For example, in your home theater system and your flat screen TV, there's HDMI and usually S video connections as well. And just to confuse things even more, the term phone connector is not only used for these quarter inch and smaller connectors, they're also used for all sorts of other connectors that are used in telephone applications. And needless to say, there's a huge array of adapters to adapt from one type of connector to another and from one application to another. And that's it for now. Let me unshare here. And
no questions in the chat. Lawrence just happens to comment that he has $30 plus of RCA stereo adapters in his basement somewhere. So if anybody's looking for them, talk to Lawrence.
Okay, thanks, Bob. Okay, well, from recording stuff, let's see what happens when you have recorded it and you play it back to yourself, because Chris has got something to tell us about that.
Yeah, tickle your funny bones. So, there was a tip about using Google Translate to proofread text, and I tried it, and I tried the proofing in Microsoft Office as well. They both work really well. I find that Microsoft Office tends to read it a little bit quicker than Google Translate does. I don't know if either of them can be adjusted somehow in terms of their speed or whatever, but anyway, I tried it out, and I highly recommend it to anybody who has to proof text. Both of them work really, really well. You just sit back, close your eyes, and let it read it back to you and listen to how things sound. One of the interesting things is that Google Translate will actually try to read absolutely everything that is you paste into the window. And I had to have a little bit of a chuckle on it. Maybe they shouldn't be reading URLs. If you can hit the play there, Alan.
My article on Windows file history, https://mailchi.mp/glasswire/glasswire-newsletter-how-to-detect-a-hidden-camera-in-your-room.
So I thought it was a little bit humorous, so just threw that in. But both of them do a really, really good job, and so I highly recommend it, and thanks again to Bill for that shout-out on that capability. I will definitely be using it in the future.
She sounded like Christmas time, Dasher and Dancer and Dasher and Dasher and Dasher.
Yeah, got stuck in a loop.
Yeah, I thought that was really funny. Okay, actually, though, to be fair, I guess you have to read it out, because if for people who are blind, for example, that's the only way they're going to figure out what you said.
True.
What the URL is.
Yeah.
Shouldn't use such long URLs. That's the answer.
Yeah, that's true.
Okay, Chris has another item here, which is another follow-up.
Oh, okay. Windows 11. So we've been talking a little bit about people asking, should they go to Windows 11 or not? And I happened across this on Twitter. Paul Thurrott, who is well known for his work with Windows, and he came out with a tweet, "What the F is this?" And he had a screenshot where he had this picture of a house with labeled home. And he says, "This home icon just appeared on my Windows 11 desktop and I can't delete it." And then he followed up with another tweet next that said, "Oh, and it's not this," which he was pointing out the idea that there are some settings where you can go into that allow you to show or not show certain things on your desktop, like the recycle bin and so forth. So it was not part of that. So somebody else replied and said, "What happens when you click it?" And Paul Thurrott replied that it opens up File Explorer in the home view. And somebody else said they have the same situation and not even after the update. And this icon appeared and disappeared after a reboot. And so I thought one of the things that was kind of interesting about this is, if you hit next there, Alan, to be fair on this, Paul Thurrott is the computer he was using almost certainly was running an insider build. So anybody who's interested in knowing about the insider builds, anybody can become part of the insider program. And what will happen is that you will get builds of Windows before the unwashed public get them. And so I'm not sure if they still have them. I think they do still have various tiers at it. You can get like real bleeding edge stuff, or you can get stuff that is just before it goes to the public sort of idea. And the insider program is Microsoft's way of beta testing. And if you belong to the insider program, I can guarantee you that strange things can and will happen, and they will be somewhat random. Microsoft does a very, very poor job of telling the insiders exactly what is happening in upcoming insider builds. They do have a web page where they highlight things, but it is by no means complete. And strange things, as Paul Thurrott had with this home icon appearing on his desktop, will end up happening. However, if you want to become part of the insider program, if you go to the settings app and go to update and security, in the bottom left-hand corner, in the left-hand panel, you'll find that there's an option there to join the insider program. A warning that if you join the insider program, sometimes to get out of the insider program, the only way is to reformat and start over. Usually once they go to an official build that goes out to the great unwashed public, if you can actually get out of the insider program at that point in time. They provide a means of doing so. However, I wouldn't count on it. Knowing what Microsoft does with insider builds and so forth, I would always consider that if I put a computer on an insider build, that likely the or possibly the only way that I'll get out of that it would be to reformat and start over fresh. But I throw it up there just in case anybody wants to get cutting-edge stuff delivered to them.
Okay, thanks, Chris. And now I have a little share here. A new scam that, as far as I'm aware of, I got this email message just the other day, and it basically says, please join my meeting, and gives me a GoToMeeting URL. Now, the interesting thing is that this gentleman right here is a colleague, and when I hover over his name here, I see the correct email address. So it is nominally coming from him, unless somebody has spoofed his email address. And they're also sending it to one of my email addresses, which I don't use usually in public settings. I give it out to friends and relatives. So how they managed to link these two things together, I'm not sure. However, there are a couple of red flags here for me, and they are as follows. First of all, he's sending me an invitation to a video conference. Now, he never does that. He never does that before he's contacted me by email, and we've made sure that we're both going to be available at 3 o'clock in the afternoon or whatever. So this GoToMeeting invitation out of the blue is a huge red flag as far as I'm concerned. And then the second thing is, you notice that it's got this URL with a kind of a custom tag on the end of it, like we do for the OPCUG meeting with our tiny URL link. Danius never uses these custom tags. It's always a straight numerical session ID code, and it changes every time there's a meeting. So those two things to me say there's a problem. So I send him an email, not by replying to this one, but sending him an email directly to his email address and say, you know, are you trying to set up a meeting? And he says, no, he's not. So then I start looking around on the web, and sure enough, I find that just a couple of days ago, July the 30th, a GoToMeeting were talking about spam emails going out, basically using free trial editions of their GoToWebinar system. Now, mine doesn't seem to be quite the same as that, but it is a GoToMeeting invite, so it's clear, and it's around about the same time. It was a day or two later than this warning. So I'm pretty convinced that it's the same problem. So if you suddenly get invitations to video conferences that you weren't expecting, I think what this thing tells you is that it goes to a web page that you probably don't want to go to, and it may pop up a registration form that you definitely don't want to fill out. And in terms of this is going to get around to Zoom one of these days, so just remember that OPCUG, we always use the same URL. And we always have the same meeting ID. So if either of those two things change, then somebody's sending you to an address that we didn't intend you to go to. But typically, you know when we send out the invites, and you know what the invites look like, so you shouldn't fall for unintended spam. If somebody invites you to a Q&A session on Tuesday morning, it's not us. Okay, moving along. Chris has got some computer basics for us.
Yeah, so this, I actually wrote about this clipboard history thing in the newsletter going back a couple of years ago, but I was recently helping somebody on their computer, and they were cutting and pasting back and forth, and I said, well, why don't you just copy everything in the clipboard and then use clipboard history to do all the pasting all in one go sort of idea. And they were not aware of the capability of this, so I thought probably a good thing to actually do a computer basics on it. So when you're normally copying or moving information from one document type to another document or within a same document, so you select your text or graphic or whatever it is, you press Control C or you select copy on a toolbar or on the menus, and then you go to where you want to insert it. Or you can do a cut if you wanted to remove it from the first part with Control X. Then you go to where you want to put that text and you paste it using Control V or again, a paste icon on the toolbar somewhere or on the menus. There will be an option for paste. So one of the issues with it is that if you copy something new to the clipboard before you actually do the pasting, the copy overwrites your previous information that got copied to the clipboard. And so, you know, this can lead to having to go back and forth one at a time, doing them one at a time, or frustration if you accidentally copy something new before you actually paste it into your other document. So it's a little bit of a tedious sort of process if you have multiple things to copy. Next. So what if you could copy something new to the clipboard and not have it overwrite previous information on the clipboard? And the answer is yes, you can. And it's clipboard history, which has been around since Windows 7. Next. So to get it, make sure that it's turned on, you go to Settings, System. And then once the system loads up, you go to Clipboard. And then on the right-hand side, there's an option for Clipboard History. Make sure that that's turned on. You can see the brief text there says that you press the Windows logo key and V rather than Control V, and that'll bring up your Clipboard History. Next. So the way it looks is you put the insertion point where you want your information pasted. You press Windows V. And then as you see over on the right-hand side, you have this little pop-up comes up, and it has the last 25 items that were copied to the clipboard. There is a maximum of 4 megabytes per item, which in most cases is plenty. If you have something that is over 4 megabytes, it won't be on your clipboard history, but you can do a regular Control-V to paste it in anyways. So you can scroll down. There's a scroll bar if you have more than, I can see 4 items on the clipboard history there. If it's down below that, I can use the scroll bar. I can use the arrow keys to arrow up and down, and I can click on any one item to paste it in, or I can use the arrow key or the enter key paste in whatever is the highlighted entry on there, and the information will then be pasted into at the insertion point. So really, really handy way of doing things. Now, a couple of things about clipboard history. It's lost on reboot. So if you reboot your computer and then you do a Windows V, it'll be empty. The clipboard history will be empty. If you want things to remain longer, you'll see on the right on the graphic, there's a dot, dot, dot for each of the entries in the clipboard history. And if you click on that, you get a little pop-up come in, and you can choose pin. And that will keep it on the clipboard history, not only for your current session. So if you copy more than 25 items, you will still end up with those pinned items will be retained. But it also survives a reboot, which is really nice. So if I have boilerplate text, such as you see there, my name and address in there, that if I frequently paste that or type that into a document, I can put it onto the clipboard history, pin it, and then it is always there. So anytime I want to insert that, I can call up clipboard history. It might be way down the list, but it's faster than typing it in manually. So really great for anything that's boilerplate type information or logos or anything that you want to paste in frequently into documents. Really good way to keep it on there. And next.
I noticed that there's a clear all, but there doesn't seem to be a select all.
I guess it, well, yeah, it does an automatic, I guess, of selecting everything and then clearing it. Oh, you want to clear just the current one?
No, I
that'd be the delete.
What happens if you wanted to maintain them all?
Oh, you'd have all. Yeah, you'd have to go in and individually pin them. Yeah, I think the idea there is that you probably don't want to keep too many of these items around for a really long time is probably what the thinking is.
Yeah.
There is one other thing that is in the article that I wrote in the newsletter as well. And that, let's go to the next slide. That has to deal with syncing across devices. So this is kind of neat. I don't use it because one of the requirements for this is that you must be signed into multiple computers using the same Microsoft account. So not using a local account. And I use local accounts on all my computers. So this won't work for me ever. I don't want to change back to a Microsoft account for some other reasons that I won't go into in great detail here. But if you are signed in, most people probably do sign into their Windows using Microsoft account. And if you are signed in on multiple computers, what you can do is pretty cool. You can copy the clipboard contents on one computer, go to the other computer, and you can paste it by calling up clipboard history. So a really kind of neat way of transferring information, small bits of text or graphics, from one computer to another. Now, they say here it only works for text. There is some sort of conflicting information I've seen. Some information has indicated that it works for graphics as well. So I don't know if this was a version of Windows that changed that behavior or whether it works at all. As I said, I don't use Microsoft accounts, so I can't test it. If anybody does use Microsoft accounts and wanted to update a future Q&A to say whether it truly does work with graphics as well as text, by all means, let us know on that. And so to get to that setting, you go back to that settings system clipboard, and below the clipboard history, there's an option for sync across devices. And you can see there where it says I have to sign in using a Microsoft account, and it's not a matter of doing it once. I actually have to change the way that I log into the computer to a Microsoft account in order for it to be enabled. And so you have to turn that on both computers. There's one additional option in here that is kind of cool if you do that, is that you don't necessarily want things to be always copied to this Microsoft server is essentially where it's going to, so that the other device can pick it up. You don't necessarily want that all the time. If you turn it on, you can have it turned off by default. And then if you turn it off by default, then when you go to your clipboard history on the computer that you copy the information to, immediately call up clipboard history. It'll be at the top of the list. And on the dot, dot, dot menu, there will be a sync option. And if you choose that, it will sync it to the cloud. And then you will be able to access that item from your other computer. Again, I don't have any screenshots or anything like that because I can't turn this particular feature on. I do talk about that option as well in that newsletter article that you see on the screen. And as well, it is pasted into the chat. And Lawrence has a comment. Clipboard history, yes, convenient. If you're like me who constantly juggles passwords, not only mine but others, so non-starters, I don't want passwords to hang around. If it weren't for my profession, would likely turn it on. Yeah, I mean, that is a case in point, is if you have anything that is sensitive information, it is going to get copied into the clipboard as well. So I guess beware of that if you use that particular feature. Outside of that caution, I think it's a great feature. And I personally, I use it all the time. I think it's great.
Okay, thanks, Chris. Something to look at. I didn't know about that one either. Okay, we have a question came in about Outlook Mail. And our member here has a problem in that he has several accounts in Outlook Mail. And one of them is basically showing as a blank entry. So that's an issue. And the second thing is that although he can send and receive mail, he can't conduct any searches. So he can't look for texts and messages that he sent or contacts in his address book and that kind of thing. And sure enough, if he looked for a particular individual here, it tells him we couldn't find what you were looking for. Now, neither Chris nor I use Outlook Mail, so we have very limited suggestions. One of them was try removing the account and adding it back in. And typically, if you're using something like IMAP, then deleting all the mail folders, they'll just repopulate when you set up the account again. However, is there anybody out there who uses Outlook Mail who may have run into this kind of issue or has run into similar issues and knows who or where to ask for troubleshooting advice? And in the meantime, Chris has a comment or two, a caution or two on deleting accounts.
Yeah, I thought one of the things that was interesting about this particular question being posed is that in a more general sense, when you're trying to fix something, you know, it's always a really good idea to make sure that you can recover from something going bad. And this can be anything from doing, you know, an update to Windows or, you know, a problem like this where you're going to try to do something and you think, if I do this, it might fix it, but it might break things even worse and I might lose data. Losing data is, to my mind, the worst thing because it can be very difficult to recover from, including the possibility that, you know, you might have to restore from, you know, an image backup or something like that. An image backup is always your best last line of defense that you can get back to a working state. So with this particular problem, Outlook normally stores all data in each of the topmost folders. So actually, if you can go back, Alan, two slides. One more. So you see here we have favorites, and then we have this primary Outlook account, which is showing as this gray bar. And then there's two accounts, or two folders below it. So there's somethingelse.com and an iCloud account. So these are three different accounts. All of the data, including mail, calendar, contacts, tasks, all of the data types that Microsoft Outlook can actually deal with for those particular accounts will be within that folder. So typically what I would do is I would right-click on any one of them and then go to the properties, and that should show you the data file associated with that. So if you can move back to my slide there, Alan. So that should give you the name of the actual file that contains everything for that particular account. Normally, there'll be a PST file for POP accounts or any extra data files, data containers that you actually create, which you can do in Outlook just doing a file new, and it'll be a new data file, and it'll be a PST file. OST files are what is used for IMAP accounts. And so those are ones where it actually synchronizes information between the server and your computer, as opposed to a POP account, which just downloads everything from the server, and then optionally you can actually delete it from the server, or you can set it to actually stay on the server itself. So you typically will see it as either a PST file or an OST file on there. I suspect that when going to Outlook.com, it's probably going to be an OST file, so it'll be an IMAP connection, but I'm not 100% sure. It might be a totally different protocol that is unique to Microsoft because they own Outlook.com and they own the Outlook Mail client. So it could be something totally foreign. One of the things you could do is go onto the website for Outlook.com and see if all your mail exists there the same as you see it on the Outlook client on your Windows computer and see if it looks the same. And if that's the case, it is either an IMAP account or it is something akin to that where it is synchronizing all the information. And in that case, you probably can just, you know, do away with that particular account and recreate it. Something else you could do is that because you now have the file name, for the file that actually contains all of the email, calendar items, contacts, and tasks for that particular account, you could just make a copy of that file. So if something bad happens, presumably somehow you can get that copy reattached and you're off to the races as you are currently. I suspect it's something either in the account settings or it might be corruption in the actual data file that is causing that gray bar to appear and the lack of search capability. It's a bit of a puzzle, I think. Another thing that you could do to make sure you preserve everything is create a new data file within the Outlook client. So in Outlook, you go to File, New, Data File, give it a name, you know, call it backup of all my data or something, and then copy everything from that problem. I call it a folder. You know, it's the in the left-hand pane, the one that is that gray bar, expand that out, copy absolutely everything into that new data file. And that way, at least if nothing else, you have all your data. And so you can then do more troubleshooting, probably, as Alan alluded to, do the nuclear option, delete the account from on your computer, recreate the account, and then probably everything will get sucked down from the server again, and that's fine. Then you could do away with this extra data file if you don't need it anymore after the fact. So those are my thoughts, but as I said, I haven't used Outlook in years, so my troubleshooting capabilities when it comes to Outlook are probably quite rusty. If anybody else is a current user and has some ideas about how to troubleshoot this or how to make sure that you can recover from something bad doing the nuclear option, by all means, if you pipe up, we'll be happy to add it to the mix.
Nothing in the chat, so if anybody wants to think about that and let us know in the chat window or tell us later on by unmuting your mic. In the meantime, we'll move along, and Bob has his final organizing your music file segment.
Okay, I'm here. When I ended my last segment, did my audio or the slides freeze up or drop out?
The audio dropped out a couple of times, very, very briefly, just like for 1 second or so.
Okay. Yeah, because when I unshared the screen there, Zoom froze up for about 10 seconds.
Oh, wow. Okay. No, I think we're good to go.
Okay. Let me just share the screen here again. And okay, I wasn't actually going to be doing a part for organizing the music, but I noticed in the pre-announcement for the tonight's Q&A a few days ago that Alan says I was going to do organizing your music part 4, so I came up with something. So I came up with what are some final thoughts on organizing your music. Now, organizing your music or anything else can be a chore or it can be a bit of an adventure. Music is the soundtrack of your life. And when you hear some tune from way back when, you get swept back to that point in your life. It's a great way to remind yourself of things. And rediscovering an old favorite while you're organizing your music can bring back some of these memories and set you off on some great side projects. For example, in doing my organizing, I found a copy of Toto's song, Africa, when sorting out some old USB sticks from way, way back. And this song was a favorite of mine when it first came out in 1982. And I guess I'm dating myself a bit here, but like many of the old favorites, it had become just a memory. I hadn't heard it in quite a while and whatever. So it was great to hear it again. But the copy I had was so-so quality because it came from a cassette tape originally. So right after I rediscovered this song, by coincidence, a couple weeks later on CBS Sunday Morning, they did a great story on Toto and how Africa, which was their biggest hit, had come about. And this spurred me on to do a few things. So the first thing I did was get a copy of the CBS story using debut video capture. And I just want to note here that image on the screen there of Africa Toto is actually a 45 RPM special edition record that you can actually play on your turntable. Now, in the CBS story, there were some great live concert scenes. So I went to YouTube and found some great live videos of Toto doing some of their best songs, including three different versions of Africa in three quite unique performances. So I really like live concert videos. They're great because you get to feel the energy of the crowd, even though you're not there and whatever. So I downloaded some of these videos, including some of the audio tracks using Video Download Helper. Since the MP3 I had of Africa from the cassette wasn't very good, I went to iTunes and downloaded five of Toto's best songs using the iTunes app. And these are pretty good quality versions of it. So I took two of these new M4As, because that's the format that iTunes downloads in, including Africa, and put them on a new mixtape USB stick, along with several other songs from other artists I'd rediscovered in organizing my music, to play in the car. And of course, being very organized with my music now, I put everything into my master music library. So it shows here I've got in the music master directory, I have a subdirectory for Toto. Under that, there's an album subdirectory for the Essential Toto remastered. And there are the five songs that I downloaded. And then in the Toto directory, there is also the videos and the MP3s from the videos, as well as a copy of the CBS story, Toto to Africa and Beyond. So, it was great to rediscover these songs and make a little project out of getting all this stuff together. Now, in my original presentation, I showed that artist was used as the main sorting and organizing criteria, because that's what seems to work best for most people. However, just a few days ago, I was talking to someone who has a very extensive music collection on their computer, and it's all organized by song title, not by artist, and that's what works for him. And so when you're organizing your music or your photos or your movies or whatever, do whatever works best for you. The biggest thing you can do in organizing any of these things is to get them all in one place and not spread over several directories, several devices, on your smartphone, on some USB sticks, on two or three different computers. If you get it all into one place, that's the biggest thing you can do to get things organized. Everything else is a bonus. And just the quote there, music is the soundtrack for your life. When you hear some tune and you just get swept right back to that point in your life. This was a quote originally attributed to Kevin Bacon, and I assume that's Kevin Bacon the actor, and not Kevin Bacon, my veterinarian in North Gore. So, and that's it for tonight.
Okay, thanks, Bob.
Back to you, Alan.
Okay, so we have about 5 minutes. Any further questions or comments on what we've talked about tonight?
And how about it?
Unmute your microphone.
I don't see anything in the chat, so add it there or unmute yourself.
All right. Well, while people are thinking about that, let me just go on to say that our regular monthly meeting series will start again in the fall, and the first real monthly meeting will be on September the 14th. And this is going to be one of our members' favorite sessions. So this is your chance to, your chance for fame and glory, your chance to share something interesting in software or hardware with the group. So anything that's computer related, if you have a program that you really just found and you really like, can't do without, we'd like to hear about it. If you bought some new hardware, an $8 cable to connect your video player to your computer, and it works really well. Or maybe you know how to fix operating system issues and that kind of thing. Typically, these are short presentations. 10 to 20 minutes is more than adequate. But we're really flexible. If you want to be shorter or you want to be longer, we can probably accommodate all comers. So if you have anything that you want to share, just let us know at the suggestion box address, and we will reserve you a slot on September the 14th. And along the same lines, we're always looking for topics for presentations, and these will be, for example, main presentations, main speakers at our monthly meetings, or new topics that we can cover in our weekly Q&A sessions. So these can be computer basics, smartphone basics, questions about computer problems, again, neat things that you'd like to share with the group, all of those things we'd like to know about. I don't see anything in the chat in terms of questions. I don't know, anybody have any open microphone issues? Complete silence was the answer.
I think we are done then.
All right, well, that final thing then, final thought. Our next Q&A session will be next Wednesday, which is the 10th. And again, if you have questions or topics for sharing, send the details to suggestion box at opcug.ca. And we'll be happy to discuss things next week.
And so, just a reminder, folks, that the audio track from tonight, as well as the deck and the contents of the chat window, will be going up on the website as soon as Alan has a chance to process it all.
And as soon as Zoom deems to make it available to us.
Yeah, right.
They got really good a few weeks ago. It was really quick, and now they've gone back to being really slow in terms of processing it.
It might be just what their workload is at any particular time. So yeah. It might have been we were just unlucky for a while.
Yeah, don't know. Anyway, it will certainly be there later on tonight. So thanks, everyone. Hope you enjoyed it. Interesting topics tonight. And we'll see you next week.
Thanks, folks. We'll see you next week.